said Phineas Nigellus, still stroking his beard.
"This is no cowardly flight. You are being noble."
Harry ignored him. His hand was on the doorknob when Phineas Nigellus said lazily,
"I have a message for you from Albus Dumbledore."
Harry spun around. "What is it?"
"Stay where you are."
"I haven't moved," said Harry, his hands still upon the doorknob. "So what's the message?"
"I have just given it to you, dolt,"
said Phineas Nigellus smoothly.
"Dumbledore says stay where you are."
"Why?" said Harry eagerly, dropping the end of his trunk. "Why does he want me to stay? What else did he say?"
"Nothing whatsoever,"
said Phineas Nigellus, raising a thin black eyebrow, as though he found Harry impertinent. Harry's temper rose to the surface like a snake rearing from long grass. He was exhausted. He was confused beyond measure. He had experienced terror, relief, and then terror again in the last 12 hours, and still Dumbledore did not want to talk to him.
"So that's it, is it?"
he said loudly. "Stay there. That's all anyone could tell me after I got attacked by those Dementors, too. Just stay put while the grown-ups sort it out, Harry. We won't bother telling you anything, though, because your tiny little brain might not be able to cope with it."
"You know,"
said Phineas Nigellus, even more loudly than Harry,
"this is precisely why I loathed being a teacher. Young people are so infernally convinced that they are absolutely right about everything. Has it not occurred to you, my poor, puffed-up popinjay, that there might be an excellent reason why the headmaster of Hogwarts is not confiding every tiny detail of his plans to you? Have you never paused while feeling hard done by to note that following Dumbledore's orders has never led you into harm? No, no, like all young people, you are quite sure that you alone feel and think, you alone recognize danger, you alone are the only one clever enough to realize what the Dark Lord may be planning."
"He is planning something to do with me then," said Harry swiftly.
"Did I say that?"
said Phineas Nigellus, idly examining his silk gloves.
"Now, if you will excuse me, I have better things to do than to listen to adolescent agonizing. Good day to you."
And he strolled into his frame and out of sight.
"Fine, go then,"
Harry bellowed at the empty frame, "and tell Dumbledore thanks for nothing." The empty canvas remained silent. Fuming, Harry dragged his trunk back to the foot of his bed, then threw himself face down upon the moth-eaten covers, his eyes shut, his body heavy and aching. He felt he had journeyed miles and miles. It seemed impossible that less than 24 hours ago Cho Chang had been approaching him under the mistletoe. He was so tired. He was scared to sleep, yet he did not know how long he could fight it. Dumbledore had told him to stay. That must mean he was allowed to sleep. But he was scared. What if it happened again? He was sinking into shadows. It was as though a film in his head had been waiting to start. He was walking down a deserted corridor toward a plain black door, past rough stone walls, torches, and an open doorway, onto a flight of stone steps leading downstairs on the left. He reached the black door but could not open it. He stood gazing at it, desperate for entry. Something he wanted with all his heart lay beyond, a prize beyond his dreams. If only his scar would stop prickling, then he would be able to think more clearly.
"Harry!" said Ron's voice from far, far away. "Mum says dinner's ready, but she'll save you something if you want to stay in bed."
Harry opened his eyes, but Ron had already left the room. "He doesn't want to be on his own with me," Harry thought, "not after what he heard Moody say." He supposed none of them would want him there any more now that they knew what was inside him. He would not go down to dinner. He would not inflict his company upon them. He turned over onto his other side and after a while dropped back off to sleep, waking much later in the early hours of the morning with his insides aching with hunger and Ron snoring in the next bed. Squinting around the room, he saw the dark outline of Phineas Nigellus standing again in his portrait, and it occurred to Harry that Dumbledore had probably set Phineas Nigellus to watch over him in case he attacked somebody else. The feeling of being unclean intensified. He half wished he had not obeyed Dumbledore and stayed. If this was how life was going to be in Grim Old Place from now on, maybe he would be better off in Privet Drive after all. Everybody else spent the following morning putting up Christmas decorations. Harry could not remember Sirius ever being in such a good mood. He was actually singing carols, apparently delighted that he was to have company over Christmas. Harry could hear his voice echoing up through the floor in the cold and empty drawing room where he was sitting alone, watching the sky outside the windows growing whiter, threatening snow, all the time feeling a savage pleasure that he was giving the others the opportunity to keep talking about him, as they were bound to be doing. When he heard Mrs. Weasley calling his name softly up the stairs around lunchtime, he retreated farther upstairs and ignored her. It was around 6 o'clock in the evening that the doorbell rang, and Mrs. Black started screaming again. Assuming that Mundungus or some other order member had come to call, Harry merely settled himself more comfortably against the wall of Buckbeak the Hippogriff's room where he was hiding, trying to ignore how hungry he felt as he fed Buckbeak dead rats. It came as a slight shock when somebody hammered hard on the door a few minutes later. "I know you're in there," said Hermione's voice. "Will you please come out? I want to talk to you." "What are you doing here?" Harry asked her, pulling open the door as Buckbeak resumed his scratching at the straw-strewn floor for any fragments of rat he might have dropped. "I thought you were skiing with your mum and dad." "Well, to tell the truth, skiing's not really my thing," said Hermione. "So, I've come for Christmas." There was snow in her hair, and her face was pink with cold. "But don't tell Ron that. I told him it's really good because he kept laughing so much. Anyway, Mum and Dad are a bit disappointed, but I've told them that everyone who's serious about the exams is staying at Hogwarts to study. They want me to do well. They'll understand." "Anyway," she said briskly, "let's go to your bedroom. Ron's mum's lit a fire in there, and she sent up sandwiches." Harry followed her back to the second floor. When he entered the bedroom, he was rather surprised to see both Ron and Ginny waiting for them, sitting on Ron's bed. "I came on the night bus," said Hermione airily, pulling off her jacket before Harry had time to speak. "Dumbledore told me what had happened first thing this morning, but I had to wait for term to end officially before setting off. Umbridge is already livid that you lot disappeared right under her nose, even though Dumbledore told her Mr. Weasley was in St. Mungo's and he'd given you all permission to visit. So..." She sat down next to Ginny, and the two girls and Ron looked up at Harry. "How are you feeling?" asked Hermione. "Fine," said Harry stiffly. "Oh, don't lie, Harry," she said impatiently. "Ron and Ginny say you've been hiding from everyone since you got back from St. Mungo's." "They do they?" said Harry, glaring at Ron and Ginny. Ron looked down at his feet, but Ginny seemed quite unabashed. "Well, you have," she said, "and you won't look at any of us." "It's you lot who won't look at me," said Harry angrily.
"Maybe you're taking it in turns to look and keep missing each other," suggested Hermione, the corners of her mouth twitching.
"Very funny," snapped Harry, turning away.
"Oh, stop feeling all misunderstood," said Hermione sharply. "Look, the others have told me what you overheard last night on the extendable ears."
"Yeah?" growled Harry, his hands deep in his pockets as he watched the snow now falling thickly outside. "All been talking about me, have you? Well, I'm getting used to it."
"We wanted to talk to you, Harry," said Ginny, "but as you've been hiding ever since we got back..."
"I didn't want anyone to talk to me," said Harry, who was feeling more and more nettled.
"Well, that was a bit stupid of you," said Ginny angrily, "seeing as you don't know anyone but me who's been possessed by you-know-who, and I can tell you how it feels."
Harry remained quite still as the impact of these words hit him. Then he wheeled around. "I forgot," he said. "Lucky you," said Ginny coolly.
"I'm sorry," Harry said, and he meant it. So do you think I'm being possessed then?" "Well, can you remember everything you've been doing?" Ginny asked. "Are there big blank periods where you don't know what you've been up to?"
Harry racked his brains.
"No," he said. "Then you know who hasn't ever possessed you," said Ginny simply. "When he did it to me, I couldn't remember what I'd been doing for hours at a time. I'd find myself somewhere and not know how I got there."
Harry hardly dared believe her, yet his heart was lightening almost in spite of himself.
"That dream I had about your dad and the snake, though." "Harry, you've had these dreams before," Hermione said. "You had flashes of what Voldemort was up to last year." "This was different," said Harry, shaking his head. "I was inside that snake.
It was like I was the snake. What if Voldemort somehow transported me to London?
One day, said Hermione, sounding thoroughly exasperated, you'll read Hogwarts, A History, and perhaps that will remind you that you can't apparate or disapparate inside Hogwarts. Even Voldemort couldn't just make you fly out of your dormitory, Harry.
You didn't leave your bed, mate, said Ron. I saw you thrashing around in your sleep about a minute before we could wake you up.
Harry started pacing up and down the room again, thinking. What they were all saying was not only comforting, it made sense. Without really thinking, he took a sandwich from the plate on the bed and crammed it hungrily into his mouth.
I'm not the weapon, after all, thought Harry.
His heart swelled with happiness and relief, and he felt like joining in as they heard Sirius tramping past their door toward Buckbeak's room singing, God rest you merry hippogriffs, at the top of his voice. How could he have dreamed of returning to Privet Drive for Christmas? Sirius is delighted at having the house full again, and especially at having Harry back, was infectious. He was no longer their sullen host of the summer. Now he seemed determined that everyone should enjoy themselves as much, if not more, than they would have done at Hogwarts, and he worked tirelessly in the run-up to Christmas Day, cleaning and decorating with their help, so that by the time they all went to bed on Christmas Eve, the house was barely recognizable. The tarnished chandeliers were no longer hung with cobwebs, but with garlands of holly and gold and silver streamers. Magical snow glittered in heaps over the threadbare carpets. A great Christmas tree obtained by Mundungus and decorated with live fairies blocked Sirius's family tree from view, and even the stuffed elf heads on the wall wore Father Christmas hats and beards. Harry awoke on Christmas morning to find a stack of presents at the foot of his bed, and Ron already halfway through opening his own rather larger pile.
Good haul this year, he informed Harry through a cloud of paper. Thanks for the broom compass, it's excellent. Beats Hermione's. She's got me a homework planner.
Harry sorted through his presents and found one with Hermione's handwriting on it. She had given him, too, a book that resembled a diary, except that it said things like, do it today or later you'll pay, every time he opened a page. Sirius and Lupin had given Harry a set of excellent books entitled Practical Defensive Magic and Its Use Against the Dark Arts, which had superb moving color illustrations of all the counter jinxes and hexes it described. Harry flicked through the first volume eagerly. He could see it was going to be highly useful in his plans for the DA. Hagrid had sent a furry brown wallet that had fangs, which were presumably supposed to be an anti-theft device, but unfortunately prevented Harry putting any money in without getting his fingers ripped off. Tonks's present was a small working model of a firebolt, which Harry watched fly around the room, wishing he still had his full-size version. Ron had given him an enormous box of every flavor beans. Mr. and Mrs. Weasley, the usual hand-knitted jumper and some mince pies. And Dobby, a truly dreadful painting that Harry suspected had been done by the elf himself. He had just turned it upside down to see whether it looked better that way, when, with a loud crack, Fred and George apparated at the foot of his bed.
Merry Christmas, said George. Don't go downstairs for a bit.
Why not? Said Ron.
Mum's crying again, said Fred heavily. Percy sent back his Christmas jumper.
Without a note, added George.
Hasn't asked how Dad is or visited him or anything.
We tried to comfort her, said Fred, moving around the bed to look at Harry's portrait.
Told her Percy's nothing more than a humongous pile of rat droppings.
Didn't work, said George, helping himself to a chocolate frog. So Lupin took over.
Best let him cheer her up before we go down for breakfast, I reckon.
What's that supposed to be, anyway?
Asked Fred, squinting at Dobby's painting.
Looks like a gibbon with two black eyes.
It's Harry, said George, pointing at the back of the picture.
Says so on the back.
Good likeness, said Fred, grinning.
Harry threw his new homework diary at him. It hit the wall opposite and fell to the floor where it said happily,
if you've dotted the I's and crossed the T's, then you may do whatever you please.
They got up and dressed. They could hear various inhabitants of the house calling Merry Christmas to each other. On their way downstairs, they met Hermione.
Thanks for the book, Harry, she said happily. I've been wanting that new theory of numerology for ages, and that perfume is really unusual, Ron.
No problem, said Ron.
Who's that for, anyway?
he added, nodding at the neatly wrapped present she was carrying.
"Creature," said Hermione brightly.
"It better not be clothes," said Ron warningly. "You know what Sirius said. Creature knows too much. We can't set him free."
"It isn't clothes," said Hermione, "although if I had my way, I'd certainly give him something to wear other than that filthy old rag. No, it's a patchwork quilt. I thought it would brighten up his bedroom."
"What bedroom?" said Harry, dropping his voice to a whisper as they were passing the portrait of Sirius's mother.
"Well, Sirius says it's not so much a bedroom, more a kind of den," said Hermione. "Apparently he sleeps under the boiler in that cupboard off the kitchen."
Mrs. Weasley was the only person in the basement when they arrived there. She was standing at the stove and sounded as though she had a bad head cold when she wished them Merry Christmas, and they all averted their eyes.
"So this is Creature's bedroom?" said Ron, strolling over to a dingy door in the corner opposite the pantry which Harry had never seen open.
"Yes," said Hermione, now sounding a little nervous. "I think we'd better knock."
Ron rapped the door with his knuckles, but there was no reply.
"He must be sneaking around upstairs," he said,
and without further ado pulled open the door.
"Ugh!"
Harry peered inside. Most of the cupboard was taken up with a very large and old-fashioned boiler, but in the foot space underneath the pipes, Creature had made himself something that looked like a nest. A jumble of assorted rags and smelly old blankets were piled on the floor, and the small dent in the middle of it showed where Creature curled up to sleep every night. Here and there among the material were stale bread crusts and mouldy old bits of cheese. In a far corner glinted small objects and coins that Harry guessed Creature had saved, magpie-like, from Sirius's purge of the house. And he had also managed to retrieve the silver-framed family photographs that Sirius had thrown away over the summer. Their glass might be shattered, but still the little black-and-white people inside them peered haughtily up at him, including, he felt a little jolt in his stomach, the dark, heavy-lidded woman whose trial he had witnessed in Dumbledore's pensive, Bellatrix Lestrange. By the looks of it, hers was Creature's favourite photograph. He had placed it to the fore of all the others and had mended the glass clumsily with spellotape.
"I think I'll just leave his present here,"
said Hermione, laying the package neatly in the middle of the depression in the rags and blankets and closing the door quietly.
"He'll find it later. That'll be fine."
"Come to think of it," said Sirius, emerging from the pantry carrying a large turkey as they closed the cupboard door, "has anyone actually seen Creature lately?"
"I haven't seen him since the night we came back here," said Harry. "You were ordering him out of the kitchen."
"Yeah," said Sirius, frowning. "You know, I think that's the last time I saw him, too. He must be hiding upstairs somewhere."
"He couldn't have left, could he?" said Harry. "I mean, when you said out, maybe he thought you meant get out of the house."
"No, no. House elves can't leave unless they're given clothes. They're tied to their family's house," said Sirius.
"They can leave the house if they really want to," Harry contradicted him. "Dobby did. He left the Malfoys to give me warnings 2 years ago. He had to punish himself afterward, but he still managed it."
Sirius looked slightly disconcerted for a moment, then said,
"I'll look for him later. I expect I'll find him upstairs crying his eyes out over my mother's old bloomers or something. Of course, he might have crawled into the airing cupboard and died, but I mustn't get my hopes up."
Fred, George, and Ron laughed. Hermione, however, looked reproachful. Once they had had their Christmas lunch, the Weasleys and Harry and Hermione were planning to pay Mr. Weasley another visit, escorted by Mad-Eye and Lupin. Mundungus turned up in time for Christmas pudding and trifle, having managed to borrow a car for the occasion, as the Underground did not run on Christmas Day. The car, which Harry doubted very much had been taken with the knowledge or consent of its owner, had had a similar enlarging spell put upon it as the Weasley's old Ford Anglia. Although normally proportioned outside, 10 people, with Mundungus driving, were able to fit into it quite comfortably. Mrs. Weasley hesitated at the point of getting inside. Harry knew that her disapproval of Mundungus was battling with her dislike of travelling without magic. Finally, the cold outside and her children's pleading triumphed, and she settled herself into the back seat between Fred and Bill with good grace. The journey to St. Mungo's was quite quick, as there was very little traffic on the roads. A small trickle of witches and wizards were creeping furtively up the otherwise deserted street to visit the hospital. Harry and the others got out of the car, and Mundungus drove off around the corner to wait for them. They strolled casually toward the window where the dummy in green nylon stood, then, one by one, stepped through the glass. The reception area looked pleasantly festive. The crystal orbs that illuminated St. Mungo's had been turned to red and gold so that they became gigantic glowing Christmas baubles. Holly hung around every doorway, and shining white Christmas trees covered in magical snow and icicles glittered in every corner, each topped with a gleaming gold star. It was less crowded than the last time they had been there, although halfway across the room, Harry found himself shunted aside by a witch with a walnut jammed up her left nostril.
"Family argument, eh?" smirked the blonde witch behind the desk. "You're the third I've seen today. Spell damage, fourth floor."
They found Mr. Weasley propped up in bed with the remains of his turkey dinner on a tray in his lap and a rather sheepish expression on his face.
"Everything all right, Arthur?"
asked Mrs. Weasley, after they had all greeted Mr. Weasley and handed over their presents.
"Fine, fine," said Mr. Weasley, a little too heartily. "You, haven't seen Hela Smithwick, have you?"
"No," said Mrs. Weasley suspiciously. "Why?"
"Nothing, nothing," said Mr. Weasley airily, starting to unwrap his pile of gifts. "Well, everyone had a good day. What did you all get for Christmas?" "Oh, Harry, this is absolutely wonderful."
For he had just opened Harry's gift of fuse wire and screwdrivers. Mrs. Weasley did not seem entirely satisfied with Mr. Weasley's answer. As her husband leaned over to shake Harry's hand, she peered at the bandaging under his nightshirt.
"Arthur," she said, with a snap in her voice like a mousetrap, "you've had your bandages changed. Why have you had your bandages changed a day early, Arthur? You told me they wouldn't need doing until tomorrow."
"What?"
said Mr. Weasley, looking rather frightened and pulling the bed covers higher up his chest.
"No, no, it's nothing. It's I..."
He seemed to deflate under Mrs. Weasley's piercing gaze.
"Well, now don't get upset, Molly, but Augustus Pye had an idea. He's the trainee healer, you know, lovely young chap and very interested in, complementary medicine. I mean, some of these old muggle remedies, well, they're called stitches, Molly, and they work very well on muggle wounds."
Mrs. Weasley let out an ominous noise somewhere between a shriek and a snarl. Lupin strolled away from the bed and over to the werewolf, who had no visitors and was looking rather wistfully at the crowd around Mr. Weasley. Bill muttered something about getting himself a cup of tea, and Fred and George leapt up to accompany him, grinning.
"Do you mean to tell me?"
said Mrs. Weasley, her voice growing louder with every word, and apparently unaware that her fellow visitors were scurrying for cover,
"that you have been messing about with muggle remedies?"
"Not messing about, Molly dear," said Mr. Weasley imploringly. "It was just something Pye and I thought we'd try. Only, most unfortunately, well, with these particular kinds of wounds, it doesn't seem to work as well as we'd hoped."
"Meaning?"
Well, I don't know whether you know what stitches are."
"It sounds as though you've been trying to sew your skin back together," said Mrs. Weasley, with a snort of mirthless laughter. "But even you, Arthur, wouldn't be that stupid."
"I fancy a cup of tea, too," said Harry, jumping to his feet. Hermione, Ron, and Ginny almost sprinted to the door with him. As it swung closed behind them, they heard Mrs. Weasley shriek,
"What do you mean that's the general idea?"
"Typical Dad," said Ginny, shaking her head as they set off up the corridor.
"Stitches, I ask you."
"Well, you know, they do work well on non-magical wounds," said Hermione fairly. "I suppose something in that snake's venom dissolves them or something. I wonder where the tea room is."
"Fifth floor," said Harry, remembering the sign over the welcome witch's desk. They walked along the corridor through a set of double doors and found a rickety staircase lined with more portraits of brutal-looking healers. As they climbed it, the various healers called out to them, diagnosing odd complaints and suggesting horrible remedies. Ron was seriously affronted when a medieval wizard called out that he clearly had a bad case of spattergroit.
"And what's that supposed to be?"
he asked angrily, as the healer pursued him through six more portraits, shoving the occupants out of the way.
"'Tis a most grievous affliction of the skin, young master, that will leave you pockmarked and more gruesome even than you are now."
"What are you calling gruesome?" said Ron, his ears turning red.
"The only remedy is to take the liver of a toad, bind it tight about your throat, stand naked by the full moon in a barrel of eel's eyes. I have not got spattergoit." "But the unsightly blemishes upon your visage, young master."
"They're freckles," said Ron furiously. "Now get back in your own picture and leave me alone."
He rounded on the others, who were all keeping determinedly straight faces.
"What floor's this?"
"I think it's the fifth," said Hermione.
"Nah, it's the fourth," said Harry. "One more."
But as he stepped onto the landing, he came to an abrupt halt, staring at the small window set into the double doors that marked the start of a corridor signposted "Spell Damage." A man was peering out at them all with his nose pressed against the glass. He had wavy blonde hair, bright blue eyes, and a broad, vacant smile that revealed dazzlingly white teeth.
"Blimey!" said Ron, also staring at the man.
"Oh, my goodness," said Hermione, suddenly sounding breathless. "Professor Lockhart."
Their ex-defense against the dark arts teacher pushed open the doors and moved toward them, wearing a long lilac dressing gown.
"Well, hello there," he said. "I expect you'd like my autograph, would you?"
"Hasn't changed much, has he?" Harry muttered to Ginny, who grinned.
How are you, Professor?"
said Ron, sounding slightly guilty. It had been Ron's malfunctioning wand that had damaged Professor Lockhart's memory so badly that he had landed here in the first place. Though, as Lockhart had been attempting to permanently wipe Harry and Ron's memories at the time, Harry's sympathy was limited.
"I'm very well indeed, thank you," said Lockhart exuberantly, pulling a rather battered peacock feather quill from his pocket. "Now, how many autographs would you like? I can do joined-up writing now, you know."
We don't want any at the moment, thanks,"
said Ron, raising his eyebrows at Harry, who asked, "Professor, should you be wandering around the corridors? Shouldn't you be in a ward?" The smile faded slowly from Lockhart's face. For a few moments he gazed intently at Harry, then he said,
"Haven't we met?"
Yeah, we have," said Harry. "You used to teach us at Hogwarts, remember?"
"Teach?" repeated Lockhart, looking faintly unsettled. "Me? Did I?"
And then the smile reappeared upon his face so suddenly it was rather alarming.
"Taught you everything you know, I expect, did I? Well, how about those autographs, then? Shall we say a round dozen? You can give them to all your little friends, then, and nobody will be left out."
But just then, a head poked out of a door at the far end of the corridor, and a voice said,
"Gilderoy, you naughty boy, where have you wandered off to?"
A motherly-looking healer wearing a tinsel wreath in her hair came bustling up the corridor, smiling warmly at Harry and the others.
"Oh, Gilderoy, you've got visitors. How lovely. And on Christmas Day, too. Do you know, he never gets visitors, poor lamb. And I can't think why. He's such a sweetie, aren't you?" "We're doing autographs,"
Gilderoy told the healer with another glittering smile.
"They want loads of them. Won't take no for an answer. I just hope we've got enough photographs." "Listen to him," said the healer, taking Lockhart's arm and beaming fondly at him as though he were a precocious 2-year-old. "He was rather well known a few years ago. We very much hope that this liking for giving autographs is a sign that his memory might be coming back a little bit. Will you step this way? He's in a closed ward, you know. He must have slipped out while I was bringing in the Christmas presents. The door's usually kept locked. Not that he's dangerous, but—"
She lowered her voice to a whisper.
"Bit of a danger to himself, bless him. Doesn't know who he is, you see. Wanders off and can't remember how to get back. It is nice of you to have come to see him."
Said Ron, gesturing uselessly at the floor above. "Actually, we were just, But the healer was smiling expectantly at them, and Ron's feeble mutter of, "Going to have a cup of tea," trailed away into nothingness. They looked at one another rather hopelessly and then followed Lockhart and his healer along the corridor.
"Let's not stay long,"
Ron said quietly. The healer pointed her wand at the door of the Janus Thicky Ward and muttered, "Hello, Hermora." The door swung open and she led the way inside, keeping a firm grasp on Gilderoy's arm until she had settled him into an armchair beside his bed.
"This is our long-term resident ward," she informed Harry, Ron, Hermione, and Ginny in a low voice. "For permanent spell damage, you know. Of course, with intensive remedial potions and charms and a bit of luck, we can produce some improvement. Gilderoy does seem to be getting back some sense of himself, and we've seen a real improvement in Mr. Bode. He seems to be regaining the power of speech very well, though he isn't speaking any language we recognize yet. Well, I must finish giving out the Christmas presents. I'll leave you all to chat."
Harry looked around. This ward bore unmistakable signs of being a permanent home to its residents. They had many more personal effects around their beds than in Mr. Weasley's ward. The wall around Gilderoy's headboard, for instance, was papered with pictures of himself, all beaming toothily and waving at the new arrivals. He had autographed many of them to himself in disjointed, childish writing. The moment he had been deposited in his chair by the healer, Gilderoy pulled a fresh stack of photographs toward him, seized a quill, and started signing them all feverishly.
"You can put them in envelopes," he said to Ginny, throwing the signed pictures into her lap one by one as he finished them. "I am not forgotten, you know. No, I still receive a very great deal of fan mail. Gladys Gudgeon writes weekly. I just wish I knew why."
He paused, looking faintly puzzled, then beamed again and returned to his signing with renewed vigor.
"I suspect it's simply my good looks."
A sallow-skinned, mournful-looking wizard lay in the bed opposite, staring at the ceiling. He was mumbling to himself and seemed quite unaware of anything around him. Two beds along was a woman whose entire head was covered in fur. Harry remembered something similar happening to Hermione during their second year, although, fortunately, the damage in her case had not been permanent. At the far end of the ward, flowery curtains had been drawn around two beds to give the occupants and their visitors some privacy.
"Here you are, Agnes,"
said the healer brightly to the furry-faced woman, handing her a small pile of Christmas presents.
"See, not forgotten, are you? And your son sent an owl to say he's visiting tonight, so that's nice, isn't it?"
Agnes gave several loud barks.
"And look, Broderick, you've been sent a potted plant and a lovely calendar with a different fancy hippogriff for each month. They'll brighten things up, won't they?"
said the healer, bustling along to the mumbling man, setting a rather ugly plant with long swaying tentacles on the bedside cabinet and fixing the calendar to the wall with a wand.
"And, Mrs. Longbottom, are you leaving already?"
Harry's head spun round. The curtains had been drawn back from the two beds at the end of the ward, and two visitors were walking back down the aisle between the beds. A formidable-looking old witch wearing a long green dress, a moth-eaten fox fur, and a pointed hat decorated with what was unmistakably a stuffed vulture, and, trailing behind her looking thoroughly depressed, Neville. With a sudden rush of understanding, Harry realized who the people in the end beds must be. He cast around wildly for some means of distracting the others so that Neville could leave the ward unnoticed and unquestioned. But Ron had looked up at the sound of the name Longbottom, too, and before Harry could stop him, had called,
"Neville!"
Neville jumped and cowered as though a bullet had narrowly missed him.
"It's us, Neville!" said Ron brightly, getting to his feet. "Have you seen? Lockhart's here. Who have you been visiting?" "Friends of yours, Neville, dear?"
said Neville's grandmother graciously, bearing down upon them all. Neville looked as though he would rather be anywhere in the world but here. A dull purple flush was creeping up his plump face, and he was not making eye contact with any of them.
"Ah, yes,"
said his grandmother, looking closely at Harry and sticking out a shriveled claw-like hand for him to shake.
"Yes, yes, I know who you are, of course. Neville speaks most highly of you."
Thanks, said Harry, shaking hands. Neville did not look at him but surveyed his own feet, the colour deepening in his face all the while.
"And you two are clearly Weasleys,"
Mrs. Longbottom continued, proffering her hand regally to Ron and Ginny in turn.
"Yes,
I know your parents. Not well, of course, but fine people, fine people. And you must be Hermione Granger.
Hermione looked rather startled that Mrs. Longbottom knew her name, but shook hands all the same.
Yes, Neville's told me all about you. Helped him out of a few sticky spots, haven't you? He's a good boy,
she said, casting a sternly appraising look down her rather bony nose at Neville.
But he hasn't got his father's talent, I'm afraid to say.
And she jerked her head in the direction of the two beds at the end of the ward, so that the stuffed vulture on her hat trembled alarmingly.
What? Said Ron, looking amazed.
Harry wanted to stamp on Ron's foot, but that sort of thing was much harder to bring off unnoticed when you were wearing jeans rather than robes.
Is that your dad down the end, Neville? What's this?
Said Mrs. Longbottom sharply.
Haven't you told your friends about your parents, Neville?
Neville took a deep breath, looked up at the ceiling, and shook his head. Harry could not remember ever feeling sorrier for anyone, but he could not think of any way of helping Neville out of the situation.
Well, it's nothing to be ashamed of, said Mrs. Longbottom angrily. You should be proud, Neville, proud. They didn't give their health and their sanity so their only son would be ashamed of them, you know.
I'm not ashamed,
said Neville very faintly, still looking anywhere but at Harry and the others. Ron was now standing on tiptoe to look over at the inhabitants of the two beds.
Well, you've got a funny way of showing it,
said Mrs. Longbottom.
My son and his wife,
she said, turning haughtily to Harry, Ron, Hermione, and Ginny,
were tortured into insanity by you-know-whose followers.
Hermione and Ginny both clapped their hands over their mouths. Ron stopped craning his neck to catch a glimpse of Neville's parents and looked mortified.
They were Aurors, you know, and very well respected within the wizarding community,
Mrs. Longbottom went on.
Highly gifted, the pair of them. Yes, Alice, dear, what is it?
Neville's mother had come edging down the ward in her nightdress. She no longer had the plump, happy-looking face Harry had seen in Moody's old photograph of the original Order of the Phoenix. Her face was thin and worn now. Her eyes seemed overlarge, and her hair, which had turned white, was wispy and dead-looking. She did not seem to want to speak, or perhaps she was not able to, but she made timid motions toward Neville, holding something in her outstretched hand.
Again?
Said Mrs. Longbottom, sounding slightly weary.
Very well, Alice, dear, very well. Neville, take it, whatever it is.
But Neville had already stretched out his hand, into which his mother dropped an empty Drubal's blowing gum wrapper.
Very nice, dear,
said Neville's grandmother in a falsely cheery voice, patting his mother on the shoulder. But Neville said quietly,
Thanks, Mum.
His mother tottered away, back up the ward, humming to herself. Neville looked around at the others, his expression defiant, as though daring them to laugh. But Harry did not think he'd ever found anything less funny in his life.
Well, we better get back,
sighed Mrs. Longbottom, drawing on long green gloves.
Very nice to have met you all. Neville, put that wrapper in the bin. She must have given you enough of them to paper your bedroom by now.
But as they left, Harry was sure he saw Neville slip the wrapper into his pocket. The door closed behind them.
I never knew,
said Hermione, who looked tearful.
Nor did I,
said Ron rather hoarsely.
Nor me,
whispered Ginny. They all looked at Harry.
I did, he said glumly. Dumbledore told me, but I promised I wouldn't mention it. That's what Bellatrix Lestrange got sent to Azkaban for, using the Cruciatus curse on Neville's parents until they lost their minds.
Bellatrix Lestrange did that,
whispered Hermione, horrified.
That woman creature's got a photo of in his den.
There was a long silence, broken by Lockhart's angry voice.
Look, I didn't learn joined-up writing for nothing, you know.
Chapter 24 Occlumency Creature, it transpired, had been lurking in the attic. Sirius said he had found him up there covered in dust, no doubt looking for more relics of the Black Family to hide in his cupboard. Though Sirius seemed satisfied with this story, it made Harry uneasy. Creature seemed to be in a better mood on his reappearance. His bitter muttering had subsided somewhat, and he submitted to orders more docilely than usual, though once or twice Harry caught the house elf staring avidly at him, always looking quickly away when he saw that Harry had noticed. Harry did not mention his vague suspicions to Sirius, whose cheerfulness was evaporating fast now that Christmas was over. As the date of their departure back to Hogwarts drew nearer, he became more and more prone to what Mrs. Weasley called fits of the sullens, in which he would become taciturn and grumpy, often withdrawing to Buckbeak's room for hours at a time. His gloom seeped through the house, oozing under doorways like some noxious gas, so that all of them became infected by it. Harry did not want to leave Sirius all alone again with only Creature for company. In fact, for the first time in his life, he was not looking forward to returning to Hogwarts. Going back to school would mean placing himself once again under the tyranny of Dolores Umbridge, who had no doubt managed to force through another dozen decrees in their absence. Then there was no Quidditch to look forward to now that he had been banned. There was every likelihood that their burden of homework would increase as the exams drew even nearer. Dumbledore remained as remote as ever. In fact, if it had not been for the DA, Harry felt he might have gone to Sirius and begged him to let him leave Hogwarts and remain in Grimmauld Place. Then, on the very last day of the holidays, something happened that made Harry positively dread his return to school. "Harry, dear," said Mrs. Weasley, poking her head into his and Ron's bedroom, where the pair of them were playing wizard chess, watched by Hermione, Ginny, and Crookshanks. "Could you come down to the kitchen? Professor Snape would like a word with you." Harry did not immediately register what she had said. One of his castles was engaged in a violent tussle with a pawn of Ron's, and he was egging it on enthusiastically.
"Squash him! Squash him! He's only a pawn, you idiot!"
"Sorry, Mrs. Weasley, what did you say?"
"Professor Snape, dear, in the kitchen. He'd like a word."
Harry's mouth fell open in horror. He looked around at Ron, Hermione, and Ginny, all of whom were gaping back at him. Crookshanks, whom Hermione had been restraining with difficulty for the past quarter of an hour, leapt gleefully upon the board and set the pieces running for cover, squealing at the top of their voices.
"Snape?" said Harry blankly. "Professor Snape, dear," said Mrs. Weasley reprovingly. "Now come on, quickly. He says he can't stay long."
"What's he want with you?"
said Ron, looking unnerved, as Mrs. Weasley withdrew from the room.
"You haven't done anything, have you?"
"No," said Harry indignantly, racking his brains to think what he could have done that would make Snape pursue him to Grimmauld Place. Had his last piece of homework perhaps earned a T? He pushed open the kitchen door a minute or two later to find Sirius and Snape both seated at the long kitchen table, glaring in opposite directions. The silence between them was heavy with mutual dislike. A letter lay open on the table in front of Sirius.
"Ah,"
said Harry to announce his presence. Snape looked around at him, his face framed between curtains of greasy black hair.
"Sit down, Potter."
"You know,"
said Sirius loudly, leaning back on his rear chair legs and speaking to the ceiling,
"I think I'd prefer it if you didn't give orders here, Snape. It's my house, you see."
An ugly flush suffused Snape's pallid face. Harry sat down in a chair beside Sirius, facing Snape across the table.
"I was supposed to see you alone, Potter," said Snape, the familiar sneer curling his mouth. "But Black..." "I'm his godfather," said Sirius, louder than ever. "I am here on Dumbledore's orders," said Snape, whose voice, by contrast, was becoming more and more quietly waspish. "But by all means, stay, Black. I know you like to feel involved."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
said Sirius, letting his chair fall back onto all four legs with a loud bang.
"Merely that I am sure you must feel, frustrated by the fact that you can do nothing useful."
Snape laid a delicate stress on the word.
"For the order."
It was Sirius's turn to flush. Snape's lip curled in triumph as he turned to Harry.
"The headmaster has sent me to tell you, Potter, that it is his wish for you to study occlumency this term."
"Study what?" said Harry blankly. Snape's sneer became more pronounced.
"Occlumency, Potter. The magical defense of the mind against external penetration. An obscure branch of magic, but a highly useful one."
Harry's heart began to pump very fast indeed. Defense against external penetration?
but he was not being possessed. They had all agreed on that. "Why do I have to study thing?" he blurted out.
"Because the headmaster thinks it a good idea," said Snape smoothly. "You will receive private lessons once a week, but you will not tell anybody what you are doing, least of all Dolores Umbridge. You understand?"
"Yes," said Harry. "Who's going to be teaching me?" Snape raised an eyebrow.
"I am," he said.
Harry had the horrible sensation that his insides were melting. Extra lessons with Snape? What on earth had he done to deserve this? He looked quickly around at Sirius for support.
"Why can't Dumbledore teach Harry?" asked Sirius aggressively. "Why you?"
"I suppose because it is a headmaster's privilege to delegate less enjoyable tasks," said Snape silkily. "I assure you I did not beg for the job."
He got to his feet. "I will expect you at 6 o'clock on Monday evening, Potter. My office. If anybody asks, you are taking remedial potions. Nobody who has seen you in my classes could deny you need them." He turned to leave, his black travelling cloak billowing behind him.
"Wait a moment,"
said Sirius, sitting up straighter in his chair. Snape turned back to face them, sneering.
"I am in rather a hurry, Black. Unlike you, I do not have unlimited leisure time."
"I'll get to the point, then," said Sirius, standing up.
He was rather taller than Snape, who, Harry noticed, had balled his fist in the pocket of his cloak over what Harry was sure was the handle of his wand.
"If I hear you're using these occlumency lessons to give Harry a hard time, you'll have me to answer to."
"How touching," Snape sneered. "But surely you have noticed that Potter is very like his father."
"Yes, I have," said Sirius proudly.
"Well, then, you'll know he's so arrogant that criticism simply bounces off him," Snape said sleekly.
Sirius pushed his chair roughly aside and strode around the table towards Snape, pulling out his wand as he went. Snape whipped out his own. They were squaring up to each other, Sirius looking livid, Snape calculating, his eyes darting from Sirius's wand tip to his face.
"Sirius,"
said Harry loudly, but Sirius appeared not to hear him.
"I've warned you, Snivellus,"
said Sirius, his face barely a foot from Snape's.
"I don't care if Dumbledore thinks you've reformed. I know better."
"Oh, but why don't you tell him so?" whispered Snape. "Or are you afraid he might not take the advice of a man who has been hiding inside his mother's house for 6 months very seriously?"
"Tell me, how is Lucius Malfoy these days? I expect he's delighted his lapdog's working at Hogwarts, isn't he?"
"Speaking of dogs," said Snape softly, "did you know that Lucius Malfoy recognized you last time you risked a little jaunt outside? Clever idea, Black, getting yourself seen on a safe station platform. Gave you a cast-iron excuse not to leave your hidey-hole in future, didn't it?"
Sirius raised his wand.
"No!"
Harry yelled, vaulting over the table and trying to get in between them.
"Sirius, don't!"
"Are you calling me a coward?"
roared Sirius, trying to push Harry out of the way, but Harry would not budge.
"Why, yes, I suppose I am," said Snape.
"Harry, get out of it,"
snarled Sirius, pushing him out of the way with his free hand. The kitchen door opened and the entire Weasley family, plus Hermione, came inside, all looking very happy, with Mr. Weasley walking proudly in their midst, dressed in a pair of striped pajamas covered by a Macintosh.
"Cured,"
he announced brightly to the kitchen at large.
"Completely cured."
He and all the other Weasleys froze on the threshold, gazing at the scene in front of them, which was also suspended in mid-action, both Sirius and Snape looking toward the door with their wands pointing into each other's faces, and Harry immobile between them, a hand stretched out to each of them trying to force them apart.
"Merlin's beard,"
said Mr. Weasley, the smile sliding off his face.
"What's going on here?"
Both Sirius and Snape lowered their wands. Harry looked from one to the other. Each wore an expression of utmost contempt, yet the unexpected entrance of so many witnesses seemed to have brought them to their senses. Snape pocketed his wand, turned on his heel, and swept back across the kitchen, passing the Weasleys without comment. At the door, he looked back.
6 o'clock, Monday evening, Potter.
He was gone. Sirius glared after him, his wand at his side.
But what's been going on?
Asked Mr. Weasley again.
Nothing, Arthur,
said Sirius, who was breathing heavily as though he had just run a long distance.
Just a friendly little chat between two old school friends.
With what looked like an enormous effort, he smiled.
So, you're cured. That's great news. Really great.
Yes, isn't it?
Said Mrs. Weasley, leading her husband forward into a chair. Healer Smethwick worked his magic in the end, found an antidote to whatever that snake's got in its fangs, and Arthur's learned his lesson about dabbling in Muggle medicine. Haven't you, dear? She added, rather menacingly.
Yes, Molly dear,
said Mr. Weasley meekly. That night's meal should have been a cheerful one with Mr. Weasley back amongst them. Harry could tell Sirius was trying to make it so, yet when his godfather was not forcing himself to laugh loudly at Fred and George's jokes or offering everyone more food, his face fell back into a moody, brooding expression. Harry was separated from him by Mundungus and Mad-Eye, who had dropped in to offer Mr. Weasley their congratulations. He wanted to talk to Sirius, to tell him that he should not listen to a word Snape said, that Snape was goading him deliberately, and that the rest of them did not think Sirius was a coward for doing as Dumbledore told him and remaining in Grimald Place. But he had no opportunity to do so, and wondered occasionally, eyeing the ugly look on Sirius's face, whether he would have dared to even if he had the chance. Instead, he told Ron and Hermione under his voice about having to take occlumency lessons with Snape.
"Dumbledore wants to stop you having those dreams about Voldemort," said Hermione at once. "Well, you won't be sorry not to have them any more, will you?"
"Extra lessons with Snape," said Ron, sounding aghast. "I'd rather have the nightmares."
They were to return to Hogwarts on the night bus the following day, escorted once again by Tonks and Lupin, both of whom were eating breakfast in the kitchen when Harry, Ron and Hermione arrived there next morning. The adults seemed to have been midway through a whispered conversation when the door opened. All of them looked around hastily and fell silent. After a hurried breakfast, they pulled on jackets and scarves against the chilly grey January morning. Harry had an unpleasant, constricted sensation in his chest. He did not want to say goodbye to Sirius. He had a bad feeling about this parting. He did not know when they would next see each other, and felt that it was incumbent upon him to say something to Sirius to stop him doing anything stupid. Harry was worried that Snape's accusation of cowardice had stung Sirius so badly he might even now be planning some foolhardy trip beyond Grimald Place. Before he could think of what to say, however, Sirius had beckoned him to his side.
"I want you to take this,"
he said quietly, thrusting a badly wrapped package roughly the size of a paperback book into Harry's hands.
"What is it?"
Harry asked.
"A way of letting me know if Snape's giving you a hard time. No, don't open it in here,"
said Sirius, with a wary look at Mrs. Weasley, who was trying to persuade the twins to wear hand-knitted mittens.
"I doubt Molly would approve, but I want you to use it if you need me, all right?" "Okay,"
said Harry, stowing the package away in the inside pocket of his jacket, but he knew he would never use whatever it was. It would not be he, Harry, who lured Sirius from his place of safety, no matter how foully Snape treated him in their forthcoming occlumency classes.
"Let's go, then," said Sirius, clapping Harry on the shoulder and smiling grimly.
And before Harry could say anything else, they were heading upstairs, stopping before the heavily chained and bolted front door, surrounded by Weasleys.
"Goodbye, Harry. Take care," said Mrs. Weasley, hugging him. "See you, Harry, and keep an eye out for snakes for me," said Mr. Weasley genially, shaking his hand.
"Right, yeah,"
said Harry distractedly. It was his last chance to tell Sirius to be careful. He turned, looked into his godfather's face, and opened his mouth to speak. But before he could do so, Sirius was giving him a brief one-armed hug. He said gruffly,
"Look after yourself, Harry."
And next moment Harry found himself being shunted out into the icy winter air, with Tonks, today heavily disguised as a tall, tweedy woman with iron-grey hair, chivying him down the steps. The door of number 12 slammed shut behind them. They followed Lupin down the front steps. As he reached the pavement, Harry looked around. Number 12 was shrinking rapidly, as those on either side of it stretched sideways, squeezing it out of sight. One blink later, it had gone.
"Come on, the quicker we get on the bus, the better," said Tonks,
and Harry thought there was nervousness in the glance she threw around the square. Lupin flung out his right arm. Bang! A violently purple triple-decker bus had appeared out of thin air in front of them, narrowly avoiding the nearest lamppost, which jumped backward out of its way. A thin, pimply, jug-eared youth in a purple uniform leapt down onto the pavement and said,
"Welcome to the—" "Yes, yes, we know, thank you," said Tonks swiftly. On, get on."
And she shoved Harry forward toward the steps, past the conductor, who goggled at Harry as he passed.
"Here, it's Harry. If you shout his name, I will curse you into oblivion,"
muttered Tonks menacingly, now shunting Ginny and Hermione forward.
"I've always wanted to go on this thing," said Ron happily, joining Harry on board and looking around.
It had been evening the last time Harry had travelled by night bus, and its three decks had been full of brass bedsteads. Now in the early morning it was crammed with an assortment of mismatched chairs grouped haphazardly around windows. Some of these appeared to have fallen over when the bus stopped abruptly in Grimwald Place. A few witches and wizards were still getting to their feet, grumbling, and somebody's shopping bag had slid the length of the bus. An unpleasant mixture of frog spawn, cockroaches, and custard creams was scattered all over the floor.
"Looks like we'll have to split up," said Tonks briskly, looking around for empty chairs. "Fred, George, and Ginny, if you just take those seats at the back, Remus can stay with you."
She, Harry, Ron, and Hermione proceeded up to the very top deck, where there were two chairs at the very front of the bus and two at the back. Stan Shunpike, the conductor, followed Harry and Ron eagerly to the back. Heads turned as Harry passed, and when he sat down, he saw all the faces flick back to the front again. As Harry and Ron handed Stan 11 sickles each, the bus set off again, swaying ominously. It rumbled around Grimwald Square, weaving on and off the pavement. Then, with another tremendous bang, they were all flung backward. Ron's chair toppled right over, and Pigwidgeon, who had been on his lap, burst out of his cage and flew twittering wildly up to the front of the bus, where he fluttered down upon Hermione's shoulder instead. Harry, who had narrowly avoided falling by seizing a candle bracket, looked out of the window. They were now speeding down what appeared to be a motorway.
"Just outside Birmingham," said Stan happily, answering Harry's unasked question as Ron struggled up from the floor. "You keep him well then, Harry? I seen your name in the paper loads over the summer, but it weren't never nothing very nice. I said to her, and I said, he didn't seem like a nutter when we met him. Just goes to show, don't it?"
He handed over their tickets and continued to gaze enthralled at Harry. Apparently Stan did not care how nutty somebody was if they were famous enough to be in the paper. The night bus swayed alarmingly, overtaking a line of cars on the inside. Looking toward the front of the bus, Harry saw Hermione cover her eyes with her hands, Pigwidgeon still swaying happily on her shoulder. Bang! Chairs slid backward again as the night bus jumped from the Birmingham motorway to a quiet country lane full of hairpin bends. Hedgerows on either side of the road were leaping out of their way as they mounted the verges. From here they moved to a main street in the middle of a busy town, then to a viaduct surrounded by tall hills, then to a windswept road between high-rise flats, each time with a loud bang.
"I've changed my mind,"
muttered Ron, picking himself up from the floor for the sixth time. "I never want to ride on here again."
"Listen, it's Hogwarts stop after this," said Stan brightly, swaying toward them. "That bossy woman up front who got on with you, she's given us a little tip to move you up the queue. We're just going to let Madame Marsh off first, though."
There was more retching from downstairs, followed by a horrible spattering sound.
"She's not feeling her best."
A few minutes later, the night bus screeched to a halt outside a small pub, which squeezed itself out of the way to avoid a collision. They could hear Stan ushering the unfortunate Madame Marsh out of the bus and the relieved murmurings of her fellow passengers on the second deck. The bus moved on again, gathering speed, until, bang, they were rolling through a snowy Hogsmeade. Harry caught a glimpse of the Hogshead down its side street, the severed boar's head sign creaking in the wintry wind. Flecks of snow hit the large window at the front of the bus. At last they rolled to a halt outside the gates to Hogwarts. Lupin and Tonks helped them off the bus with their luggage and then got off to say goodbye. Harry glanced up at the three decks of the night bus and saw all the passengers staring down at them, noses flat against the windows.
"You'll be safe once you're in the grounds,"
said Tonks, casting a careful eye around at the deserted road.
Have a good term, okay?
Look after yourselves, said Lupin, shaking hands all round and reaching Harry last. And listen. He lowered his voice while the rest of them exchanged last-minute goodbyes with Tonks. Harry, I know you don't like Snape, but he is a superb occlumens.